Today is Sunday, April 18th, 2021. This is part 10 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Doing great today, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Toward the end of part 9, you recounted a pretty interesting backpack from Bass, South Bass, to Fossil, and then back on the top of the Supai, spelled S-U-P-A-I. And you'd found some gear that had been discarded, some backpacking equipment, and related the story of how that all happened after Art Christiansen, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N-S-O-N, I believe?
That's S-E-N.
S-E-N, thank you. Had contacted the Park Service and found out where that gear belonged. Can you pick up the thread then from that?
For sure, yeah. So did we talk about coming out the Point Weitzel route?
Right, and running into Scott Thibany, T-H-Y-B-O-N.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. That's right. Yeah. And so we actually...
Hang on, Jim, that's Thibany is T-H-Y-B-O-N-Y, I believe?
That's correct,
Thank you.
Yeah, and, gosh, I can't remember the exact details, but now that I... There was somebody had some car troubles up on the rim, too, and we wound up ferrying somebody around. Anyways, that couldn't have been Scott, and I apologize for the distraction, because I can't remember the details on that. I'd have to go back and look at my notes, but for sure, we returned to the rim and worked our way back, you know, along the roads and eventually out of the canyon, right? So it was, as you pointed out, it was in the fall of 1995, and then when Art and I did that trip, and I was still pretty, you know, whenever you finish a trip, you're always in the best shape, right? And you're kind of tired, but you're still in the best shape, and you just are wishing that you could do another trip because you could avoid all that time getting into shape on the first 5 or 6 days, right? So anyways, I came back to Phoenix, and I was able to connect with my friend Chris. And you remember Chris Beal. And I forget where Chris was living, I think in the Bay Area. But we hatched a plan to try and do Vishnu. So this would have been like the next week after Art and I finished our climb, our hike.
Okay.
And so Chris flew into Vegas, wherever he was living at the time, and I met him there, and we rented a car and drove along the North Rim, along the strip to the North Rim, and then went down, and we actually got a permit to try and climb Vishnu. So the plan was to just drop off the Cape Royal route, and then, you know, hike, there's a rappel through the Coconino there, and then you just would follow the ledges out to the saddle between Vishnu and Freya, and we were going to climb Vishnu. And this was my third attempt on Vishnu, so
oh.
I was pretty jazzed for it. I mean, the first attempt was...
Jim, did you tell us... Two questions for you. How do you spell Chris's last name? And second question is, did you recall for us your first two attempts at Vishnu?
I may have touched on them. First of all, Chris Beal's last name is spelled B-E-A-L-L.
Thank you.
And so the first time I tried to do Vishnu was, gosh, I think, yeah, here it was, in September of 96. And I had a friend from high school then named Kent McClellan, who I was hiking with in the canyon. And I also met Doug Rickard and Scott Kronberg, who we've talked about before, on the North Rim. And so the four of us were going to attempt Vishnu using the same route that that Chris and I were trying to do it in 20 years later. And unfortunately, Kent had just come off of a broken wrist or lower arm, can't remember which it was. And he had his hand was in a cast for part of this trip. And we started down the descent through the Coconino Gully there, heading out to Vishnu from Cape Royal. And Kent took a slip and refractured.
Right.
We
you
thought.
Told us that. I remember
yeah.
that now.
Yeah. Yeah. So we abandoned the climb of the attempt of Vishnu at that point, and we had a consolation prize by going out to the Dragon Head. You know, that was a long day hike. And Kent went with a broken wrist, right? When we got back to the North Rim after the aborted attempt on Vishnu, we went to a nurse's office there, and she looked it over and said, well, you better get this x-rayed and dealt with properly when you get back to Phoenix, right? But we said, yeah, we'll do that, but let's do something else in the canyon first, right? So we did this day trip out to the Dragon Head and had a lot of fun. So that was the first attempt on Vishnu. And then the second attempt, I remember we talked about it, was because Bruce and I did a ski-in from
right.
on the North Rim.
That's right. You talked about
yeah.
that, too.
Yeah, we parked in House Rock Valley there at South Canyon, and then there's a trail there that comes up to the rim. And then we skied down, for about a third, I think, of the road there down to – we essentially skied down to, like, Vista Encantada in there. And then at that point, the snow cover was so poor
right.
that we just wound up hiking. And by the time we got to the southern end of the plateau where the descent route drops off to go to Vishnu, you know, we were just kind of burned out on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I think we kind of decided we didn't have the time to do Vishnu and get back. So we just sat there. And I remember we talked about this because I still remember so poignantly to this day, you know, sitting there under the oak trees right on the lip of the rim in the winter sunshine, talking with Bruce and just chatting. And, you know, this is after we'd canceled our trip. We still had a long return to get back to the car, but we were just sitting there relaxed and enjoying the sun and the canyon view, and in a very remote setting because
yes.
it's winter and there's nobody there. So, but just another really positive experience that you keep in your mind for your entire life, really.
Mm.
And so that was attempt number two, and so you know, fast forward here, at least back to the future. To 1995, I guess it was, October, and I was going to try it again with Chris this time. So, as I mentioned, Chris and I met in Vegas, and then he rented a car, a Thunderbird, I remember, and we drove over to Cape Royal, parked the car there after getting a permit, and started down, and got down, and I remember it being, I just looked at my notes here earlier today about this trip. And I wrote in my notes, I was a little confused as to the route because I hadn't been here for over 20 years, okay? And that's in 1995. And I'm thinking here today, here it is 2021, and I'm reading these notes that are written 26 years ago about my uncertainties traversing a route that I had done 20 years prior to that point. Anyways,
so to be clear, your first attempt on that was in September of 76. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Wow. Yeah, so that was, this is diligence on your part.
Yeah, well, you know, you're just trying to tick them off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, I'm sure you've been on top of Vishnu. I mean, it's like the premier summit.
A number of times. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just draws you back.
Well, I haven't actually been up there yet, so.
Oh no! Okay.
No, I mean, yeah. This. I'm,
oh my gosh!
What I'm going to tell you, the little story with Chris didn't work out so well, but it had, you know, it definitely had a consolation. I mean, they always have a consolation.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And I haven't given up on Vishnu. I haven't given up on anything, really. You know, I've got
exactly.
plans.
Exactly.
For this fall, and we'll see what happens, right? So.
So you
but
started
anyways,
down, Chris, but you weren't quite clear of the route.
Yeah, so I had, you know, you lose time, right?
Yeah.
When you don't know the route and you're searching back and forth, you know, on ledges, you lose time. So we didn't get down as far as we wanted to in the afternoon. And there's a couple of nice campsites in on top of the Coconino.
Right.
On that route.
Right.
One right at the top of the Coconino and one kind of just directly below the descent through the Kaibab. So we stayed at the latter of those two, the descent below the Kaibab.
All right.
And camped there. And then the next day, we got up early and went over, hiked over to the Coconino and fixed the rope through the for the descent.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized after the fact that I had fixed the rope while on the return. I had fixed the rope too far to the west into the gully.
That's a bugger. That's a real no, keep going.
Yeah, because if you go far enough out on the ledge to the east, there's a little tree there, and you can fix your rope, and it's a much shorter rappel, right?
The gully passes if you're just a little if you rappel actually down the gully, and then you can kind of shift off to the east a little bit. You can get to get through the drop, but if you don't, and you're way off to the west, the other side of the gully, you got to rappel further.
Yeah. You do have to rappel, but the nice thing about doing that rappel that way, accidentally and not realizing that we were doing it wrong, was that I could see that it was really easy.
Yeah.
Climbing in that gully, right?
Yeah.
So I think I didn't do it on the return, but I mean I climbed virtually all of it free, but I didn't do all of it.
So this is the approach to the actual rappel. That it's not a there's not a gully there. It's an actual vertical wall.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So you're talking about the approach down there. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And so anyways, we negotiated all the rope work and we got down and it was, slow going and of course, I had just come off this long trip with Art, right? So I was in pretty good shape and Chris was not at the same level of shape. So we were going slow and by the time we got below the southwest face of Freya, it was pretty obvious we weren't going to make Vishnu,
Okay.
And, I mean, I think the plan was that we were going to go to Vishnu in just that day.
Right.
And do the climb and come back up to our camp, right?
That's right.
So, yeah, so, it was pretty obvious that we weren't going to be able to do this. So I said, look, Chris, we're going to have to turn around. And so at that point, we decided to climb Freya, which is a nice little summit, right?
Yeah.
Straightforward and nice views from the top. And, as I said, it was like a good consolation prize. And I had it written in my notes, we didn't so much fail on Vishnu as we succeeded on Freya.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Turn a loss into a win. So
that's right.
Yeah, and of course, even at that point, I wasn't seeing Chris very often. So it was a really great opportunity for us to reconnect after a number of years, right?
Nice.
Not seeing each other. So, yeah, a lot of fun. And another one. And by this time, I was starting to keep track, of the summits as I ticked them off. I was counting them, et cetera. And it was starting to become more of an obsession. I'd say prior to this time, it was incidental. Doing the routes was doing the climbs was secondary to my objective of just being in the canyon. But at this point, a lot of my hiking was turning into, you got to do the hiking to get to the climb, right?
Right.
You got to do the hiking to get to the summit.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of, that started to become kind of the motivating factor. It didn't happen overnight by any means, and it wasn't strictly this climb that was the trigger. I'm just saying that at that time of my life, I started being more and more interested in the summits, and that's probably why we went up Freya, just to be able to check it off, right, after we couldn't get up Vishnu.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah,
well, it is
so
a gorgeous view, and it is a wonderful hike. So.
Yeah, for sure, and it's a lot of fun. Have you been down from the Cape Royal route there?
Yeah, we climbed Vishnu once from the river and twice down that Cape Royal route.
Mm-hmm. So you've done it three times.
Right.
Oh, man.
It's gorgeous. It's really pretty. I can know why you want to climb the thing.
Oh, yeah. from any angle, you know, you look and you you're just blown away by its presence.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
So
yeah.
So anyways, we'll get there someday.
So
you know?
So then you come from Freya, you work your way back, you go back to this little saddle, and you go back up to the bottom of your fixed rope, and then you got to ascend up your fixed rope quite a ways, to get that little tree that you've tied your rope to. And then you get back up to your camp for the night and then head out the next day.
Yes, that's right. And so it was, you know, I mean, after the decision was made to return, it was fairly straightforward going, right?
Okay.
I mean, there was no pressure. There was no, you know, pressure of darkness or anything like that looming on us. And we could just take our time and relax, right?
Nice.
Which is,
yeah.
You know, which is, it doesn't often happen that way that you, at least on my hikes, that there's time to relax.
Hmm.
And so, you know, you appreciate that when it happens.
That's right.
And,
That's right.
So we got back and to the rim, and then presumably told the Park Service that we were done with our... Actually, I think by that time, if you just finished your hike and didn't call in with a problem, then I think they just... assumed you were okay.
Yes.
I'm not sure you have to.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So anyways, we just, you know, went our separate ways, went back to Vegas but I do remember getting a nice room in a hotel in Vegas. Yeah, and getting all showered up, you know, and going for a nice $6 steak or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was fun. But yeah, nice short trip, you know. But it kind of capped off the big event of the year, which was that, you know, the longer trip with Art. So
yeah.
So you know, I'm looking through my summary here, and it's just amazing how many trips we were on. Like Art and Bruce and I really clicked when we started doing these trips, and I don't know if it was because. Well, I'm sure it was partly because, you know, we were kind of rekindling lost friendships, right? There were friendships that had been dormant for some years. And also, I think part of it was because we were all three of us kind of experiencing this esplanade hiking for the first time. We kind of all got our introduction to that together, you know. Well, Bruce had certainly done one trip. He had hiked from Supai to Bass with Larry Treber. So this would have been in the mid-70s sometime. So they just did the standard, you know, Esplanade Traverse, pretty much a direct route through.
Okay.
And spent like, I don't know, 8 or 10 days, something like that, on their trip. So he had that familiarity with it. But none of us, neither Art nor myself, had been out there, and out there on, you know, Great Thumb Mesa and the area to the west, and you know, and when I would look at Harvey Butchert's map showing his routes, there were very few lines drawn in that part of the canyon. So I was kind of like thinking, well, you know, why did he never get out there? You know, why is it that much of an unknown? Is it that hostile or difficult to move around? So it was. It was a very interesting time.
Did you ask Harvey that question straight up?
No, I never did.
Okay.
No, I never did.
Okay.
You know, and by this time, we're talking mid-90s now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was getting on.
Oh, yeah. He was basically, his career was over by then.
Yeah. But certainly, I met him after that. It was, I'm not sure what year it was that I actually went over to his place in Sun City there and visited with him.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, it was around this, in this era, and
okay.
we didn't talk about that. At least I don't recall us talking about it. So.
If we're not jumping ahead too much, what do you recall about that visit with Harvey and his wife Roma, R-O-M-A, in Sun City?
Well, I remember that I had corresponded with Harvey a fair number of times, I mean, you know, 8 to 10 times, and filling him in on hikes and climbs that I did and asking for advice on hikes and routes. But I never met him until that time, and I knew, you know, that the years were passing by, and he wouldn't be around forever.
Right.
So I decided I was going to make this pilgrimage out to Sun City. So I got in touch with him, and through, I'm not sure how I got in touch with him, but his number was in the phone book, I think.
Okay.
So I connected with him and set up a meeting, and went out and visited. And I think I was there for about 2 hours, something like that. And,
okay.
And we just chatted about routes and hiking, and you know, I remember both he and Roma were extremely gracious. I mean, she served us like orange juice and fruit, and you know, at that point, well, our Harvey told me, look, I don't do anything anymore. I'm just becoming a historian, you know, keeping track of things that people are doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the time had taken its toll. And, I mean, he was getting aged and just couldn't really do the hiking anymore, so at least the significant hiking that he had done earlier. And I just explained to him, I'm sure, how much his writing and his adventures and his notes in the special collections of the library in Tucson, you know, University of Arizona Library in Tucson, had inspired me over the years to go into the canyon, right? And I, other than that, Tom, I can't tell you any significant details about my meeting with him, other than it was just a very, you know, enjoyable experience, and I'm very glad that I was able to do that.
Cool.
You know, it's very similar, I think, to another experience I had more recently, which relates to the kind of the same era, really, because when I was in graduate school in California, I, of course, you know, was young and learning my science, and I would read these papers written by scientists, and particularly a series of papers written by a fellow named Masayuki Noda, in Japan, and
how do you spell that? His name?
Masayuki. That's his first name, and his last name is Noda, Noda.
Thank you.
And I read Noda's papers, and he wrote these beautiful, elegant papers describing certain types of clams that lived in the Cretaceous oceans of the Pacific region, right? And we had the same clams in California where I was, in the Cretaceous rocks of California where I was doing my research. And so, you know, this was before the era of email, of course, and if you wanted to get in touch with somebody, you had to write them a letter and or type it. And I did that. I did correspond with him on a number of occasions, but his English was not that good. Although his papers were impeccably written. And I realized after the fact that it's because he always collaborated with another Japanese paleontologist named Tatsuro Matsumoto, and Matsumoto's English was very good. And so, you know, he provided the quality of English control. But Noda's papers were just so beautifully crafted and put together, not only from the discussion and the presentation of the data, but also the photographs, the tables, the line illustrations. It was just, I was just very taken by that when I was a graduate student. And I tried to model my own scientific contributions in part on that quality, right?
Huh. Yeah.
So, you know, the story is that I'm trying to get to is that when I went to Japan about 5 years ago, I've been there many times, but I decided I wanted to take a trip down to the South Island of Japan and visit with Noda.
Oh, wow.
And just to explain to him that, you know, his work had been seminal in inspiring me to go on and become a professional paleontologist and to study the discipline of paleontology that I actually pursued. And so I kind of did the same thing that I did with Harvey. You know, I contacted another colleague in Tokyo before we went to Japan. And I said, I'd like to visit with Noda. Can you set up a meeting for me. And so my colleague Masakawa did just that. He said, okay, you know, he wrote to, by this time there was email, so he contacted NOTA and set up an appointment for a time that I was going to be in the area. And on that day, I went to his house, and again, his wife and he were very gracious, and his wife set out tea and biscuits. And it was kind of awkward because NOTA's English was very poor, and of course, my Japanese was non-existent, right?
I
had written out an English text of what I wanted to say, and my colleague Masaki had translated that from English into Japanese phonetically, right?
Yeah.
So that I could phonetically speak what I wanted to convey to him. And I told him the story about how I'd been a graduate student, you know, and his work had inspired me. His scientific contributions had inspired me in my own pursuit of paleontology in California. And I wanted him to know that, right?
That
he had been my mentor. And it turns out he was just a, you know, he was a very knowledgeable person about this science, but he was just a high school biology teacher.
Wow.
And, I mean, I knew that before I went there and visited him, but it was all the more, you know, important, I think, that to me that I recognize him and tell him that, you know, he had been such an inspiration to me. So it was very similar to the experience I had with Harvey, you know, meeting him and his wife and being able to relate to him how much he had motivated me and inspired me to do the things I did. So,
right. Wow.
Yeah, kind of interesting how life kind of goes in circles, you know.
Well, and we do, as we go through life, we get a chance to pay back to our elders and to recognize those that were inspirational to us, and that's a wonderful thing.
It sure is, yeah. Yeah, I think it's important to do, too.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. So, I get a little choked up.
Well, 1999 turned into 2000. I also
did 96.
How did I get 99? Oh, it was 95.
Actually, 95,
right.
I think it was.
Fall of 95. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, no, that's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Messed up here. Okay. So, 1995, that fall of 95. And then I've got a note here about Ernie Kuncel, spelled K-U-N-C-L, to ask you about.
Oh, right. Yeah. Death in the Grand Canyon. And I think we were talking about this a few weeks ago, a couple sessions ago. And how I had read the book about, you know, Death in the Grand Canyon by Michael Giglieri, I think it is.
That's right. And
and realized that most of the people who are running into problems in the canyon are the people who aren't really prepared for what they're getting into. And so, I mean, that I recall the story of the closest, I guess, I ever got to death in the Grand Canyon was, well, I did tell you the story about how we were camped in Hance Creek or Cottonwood Creek one day, and the helicopter landed right next to us because they were looking for a fellow who had gone missing on the Tanner Trail,
right?
And he eventually they found him, and he had passed away on the upper part of the Tanner there in the snow. But before that, when I was planning this, I did this long trip that I think we talked about early on in 1973, where I went from Hack Canyon over to Phantom Ranch.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, you know, at that time I did get a permit for that big trip. And one of the things that, to get that permit, I worked with Ernie Kuncel. You know, I communicated with him by a letter and I think one visit. And talked to him about my gear, my route, and we did talk about that. I remember that.
We did.
He gave me advice on routes and whatnot. But eventually, he also told me I needed to carry this transmitter, which was about a pound, I think, and it would communicate. It would send a distress signal up to overhead passing airliners if I got into trouble. It was the closest thing to a PLB, right, that they had back then.
Right.
And my understanding at the time was that it was illegal to use these things. because it would have been a citizen communicating with an airline, you know, on an airline frequency.
Right.
But, you know, between Ernie and I, he said, well, what do you want? You know, do you want to just perish there with you know, no opportunity to be saved or what? And so, yeah, it made a lot of sense to carry this thing. And so he gave that to me. And so he, just as I was leaving on the trip, right, so I basically met him in his office at the South Rim in the administrative building there. And you know, this was just before I was going to leave. The next day, I was going to head around to the north side there and start this trip. And I was hitchhiking then too. So I had all my gear and we did our final checkout. And then I'm sitting at his desk and the phone rings and he picks up the phone. He says, you know, immediately there's a sense of urgency and gravitas in his voice. And he says, you know, he starts saying, okay, you know, yeah, okay, yeah, what happened? Oh, wow, sounds bad. And he says, okay, I'll be right over there. So then he hangs up the phone, and he turns to me, and without batting an eye, he says, yeah, we just had a visitor fall off Maricopa Point. You want to go over and help retrieve the body?
Hmm.
And, of course, you know, here I am contemplating this six-week trip solo through the canyon.
Right.
And it, the last thing I wanted to do at that point was to go help retrieve a body. So I politely declined and then we separated and went our ways. Right. And he to recover the body and myself to go on and do this hike. And you know, I mean, I had a good experience with Ernie. There was another time, which would have been after that long trip, a couple of years later, when I was invited to do some rescue practice work with the local with the Flagstaff search and rescue group.
Okay.
And so most of the work we were doing was like on using ropes and whatnot to
yeah.
set up stretchers and things like that. But I remember there was this session up at the canyon, and we did some stretcher rope lowers and raises off some of the cliffs, and then the Park Service, through Ernie, decided to let us use and check out this new cable operation that they had set up and or established. And so, you know, he invited me and Bruce Grubbs, who was involved in this effort too, and I think a fellow named Ken Walters from
yep.
Flagstaff. You know,
sure.
I'm sure you know Ken.
Yep.
I mean, he invited us to participate in this cable technique workshop. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. And I remember getting lowered off of some point like Maricopa Point. I'm not sure it was that one, but getting lowered on this quarter-inch cable, it was, like, pretty unnerving, you know, because the thing about a cable is that there's more tensile strength in it. And, or I should say there's less stretchability. I'm not
right.
quite sure of the physics involved, but a nylon rope, you know, if you drop, it's going to stretch, whereas if you're on a cable and it drops, it's going to rupture, and break. And I was thinking, if that cable snags, you know, it could be pretty grim. But anyways, I mean, this is an aside, but I just, you know, wanted to say that Ernie was always very polite to me and
mm-hmm.
supportive.
Cool.
And, you know, seemed like a gentleman at the time. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, that was my death in Grand Canyon story. It,
okay.
it wasn't, like, anything proximal, and that's fine by me.
Exactly.
Of course, want to be as far away from that as possible. So.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So what's next on your list of climbs or hikes?
Yeah.
In,
okay, I mean, I've got a million of them, but yeah. So, you know, I mentioned that Art and Bruce and I, you know, we reconnected in '95 on that Mount Katamiba trip, and then Art and I did the longer trip from Bass to Enfilade, and then we were just having such a great time, the three of us, that we decided to do another trip, and this was going to be back over to the east side and into Nankoweap.
Okay.
And, you know, I was kind of interested in Nanqui. Well, I've always loved that. I think that's my favorite area of the Grand Canyon, simply because there's just so much dramatic variation, you know, from the river, basically what the Sonoran Desert almost ecozone, up to the spruce fir forest up on the rim, you know, and you can be down in the red wall there and be surrounded in spruce forest. It's really impressive country. And so I wanted to get back into there, and I also knew there were a lot of summits that I hadn't climbed yet. So this was an opportunity to perhaps pick a few off, right? So Bruce and Art they've always been very patient, you know. They're not so much into the summits themselves.
Okay.
But they're happy to sit there and take a few hours off while I go do something.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's always worked out very well. And we planned this trip into Nanqueweep, but we wanted to do it a little bit different way than any of us had gone in there before. So we went down the route, which is north of the Boundary Ridge there on the north side of Nanqueweep.
Yep.
So when you come go east from Saddle Mountain and you follow the height of land there.
Right.
You get to a point which overlooks the Colorado River, and there's a route down right there.
Right there.
But if you go a half a mile to the north, there's another route down.
Correct.
And I think at the time we didn't realize we weren't aware of the more direct route.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if we did or not, but we certainly wanted to go down. We went down the other one, and
it's a sort of a northeast chute that drops you down to the top of the red wall, just north of 49.9 Mile Canyon.
That's right. Yeah, you have to contour around on the Supai. That's what we did.
Okay.
To get to, you could go straight down for sure to the red wall and then follow the red wall rim around. But our objective was to get into Nanqueweep.
Okay.
And so, we kind of stayed high in the Supai, and there's a big butte up there between 49.9 and Nanqueweep.
Yeah. Supai Butte, unnamed, nice little kind of a, looked like a little hat sort of a.
Yeah, that's right. Have you climbed it?
No. Have you?
No.
Did you guys?
No, I haven't climbed it. It's on the list.
Okay.
hopefully this fall, actually.
Okay.
You know, if all goes well, that's the plan I've got with Mark Coleman. So.
Fine.
But anyways, we wanted to do this. Oh, I remember what it was now. We wanted to go. I wanted to go this way, because I wanted to go down and connect with the route I had done up 49.9 through the red wall. So, I talked about a hike that I did with my uncle from Dallas. We went down into Nanqueweep. This would have been in the mid-70s. And if I didn't, it was about a five-day trip. And my uncle had read The Man Who Walked Through Time.
Right.
And he'd been really inspired by this book. He was not an outdoorsman, but he really was inspired by this book.
Okay.
Which I gave him to read, because he said, "What, you know, why do you go down there? Why do you do this kind of hiking?" And I said, "Well, you can read this book, and it might give you some ideas." And so he read that book, and he was really inspired. And he said, "You got to take me down there, right? You got to take me down there in the Grand Canyon." And he eventually settled on this area. And of course, you know, I had a lot of things I wanted to do at that time, and least on the list was to take my uncle down, you know, on a guided trip,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh.
But I realized it was a family duty, and I knew I liked John a lot, so we had a fun time. It was also the time that Bruce Grubbs and Larry Treiber did the first ascent of Malagosa Crest,
okay. And
they had asked me to go on that trip, but I couldn't go on it because, you know, I had to go with my uncle on this other hike. Anyways, John and I went down into Nanqueweep, and at one point there, I said to myself, I got to do something, you know, that's going to be kind of inspiring rather than just hiking down the trail and hiking out the trail and going up to the granary. So I told John, look, relax here for a few hours. I'm going to hike up river a couple miles and see if I can do a climb up, you know, to the top of the red wall. So I did that up to, I went up to 49.9 along the river and then started up the red wall. And quite honestly, Tom, I could not find the route through the uppermost part of the red wall.
Okay.
And, you know, there wasn't any...
What year was this?
Well, this would have been, like 1975 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was very little in the way of trail, river runner trail up there. You know, I don't remember any. And,
probably wasn't one.
Yeah. But I knew there was a route because Harvey had, talked about it,
okay.
You know. And so I thought, well, I mean, Harvey's been up it should be okay. And I remember getting into some really dicey red wall traversing, you know, and I could see these ledges that looked like they went across around a little bowl. And I thought, well, I wonder if that's the route. But you know, because I was out there and my uncle didn't really know where I was. And
right.
I just turned around and went back.
Okay.
Right. And so when we come back here in 96, in April of 96, I wanted to try and connect that route up.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was the objective for taking that northern
Northern chute. Yeah.
The northern chute. Yeah.
Okay.
So we followed the Supai around there, and Art and Bruce relaxed probably in the shade of that Hat Butte somewhere.
Uh-huh.
While I went down and connected, and of course by this time, 96, there was a very obvious river runner's trail.
Yes.
And I could not believe how simple the whole traverse through the red wall was.
Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah, and it was just like, I'm pretty sure I was in the same place, but I was looking at it from a different perspective, you know, from below looking up or across, and there was no evidence that anybody had been there before. People had been, but you just couldn't tell it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, I turned around and went back, and to find out 20 some odd years later that I was right there and it was actually quite simple was really, you know, kind of a rush. It was pretty interesting, pretty fun.
Cool.
So yeah, so we did that, and then I went and rejoined the boys and we followed around dropped down to the Red Wall Rim there, and then went around into the descent down Little Nankweep Creek.
Right.
Which is a lot of fun. I'm sure you've been up that many times.
Yeah.
So that's but we didn't, you know, you couldn't actually see any sort of a trail or route at the time. And I remember casting around in the late afternoon light, you know, not actually knowing for sure that the route dropped down this buttress,
mm-hmm.
You know, because
yes. Yep.
It just wasn't at all evident. And then,
right.
You know, you look over it and my gosh, there's a couple steps down there, and you know, it all comes together, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, it's a beautiful little route.
Yeah, it is really, really, really neat. So we went down down that route and then camped at the river, which was a beautiful spot, of course. And then our objective was to the trip was to spend time in Upper Nankweep, right?
Okay,
we wanted to go see the Cold Bridge,
yes.
And then we thought we'd do some climbs too. So, you know, the next day we hiked up Nankweep Creek and to some distance up. I think it was to about the area, certainly where the main, you know, the arms come down from Hutton and Swilling,
mm-hmm.
And then you have the arm going up to Cold Bridge, and so it was a convenient spot, let's put it that way. And we camped in that area. And so then the next day we continued on up to Cold Arch, it just without packs, you know, just day packs.
Nice, yeah.
And, it was just a very pleasant walk, you know, longer than I expected. It
mm-hmm,
did take
mm-hmm.
longer than I expected. And it was, but, you know, there's no difficulties. I think there's one dry fall in the Tapiz. And that you have to work around, but nothing significant. And the neatest thing about it was that we could get right up under it. You
nice.
Know, you can you can get climb up right beneath the thing and stand in there and kind of marvel at it. And we could see cables and ropes that were dangling. And Art told me these were from cavers who'd
really?
Been in there.
Oh,
yeah, that's what he how he explained it. So yeah, he's Art is a sometime caver, and he has friends who are in the caving community.
Okay.
And they've told him stories about some Arizona caves and Grand Canyon caves that are quite confidential because the caving community is really tight-lipped, you know.
You bet.
So,
for good reason. So.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So that was a lot of fun to see that arch. Definitely a high point. And then, you know, the we also had climbing that we wanted to do. So so the next day we decided that we were going to climb Novinger Butte.
Okay.
And this is a Redwall Butte up by up in pretty high up in the main arm of Nankoweap. And it's fairly straightforward. It's just third-class ledges, you know, second-class ledges that you piece together back and forth. And so it went straightforward. And I remember that it had been really hot when we were down on the river early on in the trip. And Bruce had a little thermometer, and he said it got up to 89 degrees.
Mm.
And when we were up on Novinger, we actually had graupel on us, you know, falling on us with a heavy wind.
Wow.
And I remember we were sheltered there, and at that time I was hiking in shorts, you know, and high top tennis shoes or something like that, and I did have a little rain wind jacket and my toque, right? But I was not really prepared for that kind of weather. Of course, it's a passing thing, right? It's not like a long-term storm setting.
Right.
But we just sat there and under a semi ledge in the red wall and shivered while we got spit on by this grouper. And so then we started down, and those two guys said, "Well, we're going to head down to camp." And it was fairly late in the afternoon, and I said, "Well, look, you guys mind if I go climb Allsap, which is a Supai Butte, which is just to the southeast of Novinger?" And they said, "No, fine, go ahead, you know, do your thing." And so I left them, and they continued down, back down to the bed of Nankoweap. And I ran up Allsap, and I remember it was kind of challenging putting together the route.
Hmm.
And there was one spot where there was you know, this was in April, so springtime, and there was a residual snow pack or snow bank that reached way up this gully, but it was really, really steep. And I remember it was kind of dicey negotiating that in my tennis shoes. But anyways, I got on top of that, and I was coming down, and I thought, well, what's this Ehrenberg Point? Now, I'm not sure. Are you familiar with Ehrenberg?
No. I'm not familiar with Novinger or Allsap, and I'm wondering, how would you spell those?
Oh, okay. Sure. Well, Novinger is Novinger.
Got it.
And Allsap is Alsap.
Got it.
And Ehrenberg is Ehrenberg.
Okay.
And
so Ehrenberg must be near Allsap.
Yeah, they're all three very closely
located
within about a kilometer.
Oh, very close.
And Novinger and Allsap are distinct buttes. I should say Novinger is, well, Allsap is the most distinct because it's a Supai Butte.
Okay.
Novinger is a high point of Redwall. You know, it's not as prominent as, say, Hutton, but if you're familiar with Dupa, which is next to Hutton, it's kind of like a blister on the ridge of limestone, right? And so Novinger's kind of like that. And Ehrenberg is actually a point, and it doesn't look like much at all except for below. When you're down in Nankoweap Creek looking up at it, it looks very imposing.
Interesting.
And,
and
so I was particularly interested in Ehrenberg because one of my earlier trips is when I climbed up Burke Point on a solo trip in the 70s, late 70s. I had actually started hearing voices in the canyon.
Hmm.
And I had my Bushnell Custom Compact binoculars with me, and I pulled them out, And I could see guys climbing on Ehrenberg Point.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really a trip. And I found out later that was Jim Ullman.
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Yeah, and his crew from Flagstaff, when they did the first descent. So I was in the canyon when they did that, a few kilometers away, and actually, you know, got to see them doing that. So I was really keen when I was up there with Art and Bruce to check this out for myself, you know. And so Ehrenberg is like the neatest pinnacle. It's a big buttress, and as I said, from down below, it looks very prominent. It looks like a big prow of a ship rising above you, and it has a blocky top to it, a cap, right? But very, very sheer on all sides through pretty much the entire red wall.
Right.
But when you get around to the back side of it, so this is the south side, the gullies come up
from
the sides, right? And there's actually only about 150 feet of red wall that rises above the gully. And right at the level of the top of the gully on Ehrenberg, on the east side, there's this ledge. It's like 6 feet wide, and it's flat.
Wow.
And it goes out from the gully, traverses, you know, along the southeast side, then it turns like 90 degrees and goes along the east side, and then it turns like 75 degrees and goes along the northeast side. And you're just walking on this flat sidewalk.
Wow.
It's just tremendous. And by the time you get out there, of course, you've got the full drop of the red wall
below you,
dropping off below you, you know. But there's, I mean, it's nothing that you have to be nervous about as a hiker.
Right, it's 6 feet wide.
Yeah, 6 feet wide. So, you know, I was really, really jazzed to be up on that. And then, and then when I got to the actual route, it was like, wow, you know, I think I can almost do this. And which is a good thing I didn't try it, because it is a little bit harder than, you know, I should have been doing by third classing. So I didn't, but I looked at it and I kind of, you know how you kind of start to climb up on things, you know, you test the first couple of moves, you know, and I just said, no, this is just too risky. You know, it's not that difficult to climb, but you know, it is something you don't want to mess up on. So
yeah, late in the day.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyways, I went reversed the route, you know, and I start down and headed down through the red wall and gullies, and then you have to, when you get to the Tapetes, there's a dry fall, and you have to go out of the drainage and work your way a little to the west, and there's a descent gully. And Harvey had pioneered this route, you know, a long time ago, so in the 60s, so we knew about it. And, of course, I knew that Bruce and Art had gone down this, right, earlier that day before me, because they went straight down from Novinger while I went up to Alsop. And I could see their tracks going back and forth, and so it was a little bit difficult initially to find, you know, the precise drop-off point. But you know, I did it, and I negotiated, and I don't remember it being any big deal at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But quite honestly, I was back there a couple of years ago with my friend Mark, and the first time we tried Ehrenberg, it was 2 years ago.
Okay.
And we backed off Ehrenberg for another reason. I'll get to another story later on. And we went down the same way, and in 2019, we had a heck of a time finding this route, and we actually repelled it.
Oh, interesting.
So it was, you know, it just goes to show you how your perspective changes from visit to visit, right?
Yeah,
so, you know, in 96, I went down that in the semi-darkness without a rope and just didn't remember anything about it. Just waltzed down it, right? So anyways, that was a fitful ending for that day. And I remember I had to race down Nankweep Creek in the dark,
fading
light,
yeah,
because they were camped. Our camp gear was downstream quite a ways, but I, you know, I joined them and everything was fine. And
cool.
And yeah, the so just to finish up this trip here, I'll try and do it off quickly. But we're going to go out, end our trip by going out the route between Marion and Sieber Points, right?
Okay.
And which we hadn't been. I had been down it a long time before that in the 70s, but the three of us hadn't done it before.
Hmm.
And so the next day we put our packs together and we walked down to where that drainage enters the main arm of Nanquip Creek. And I said, look, I'd like to try and climb Barbancita if you guys are okay with that. And they said, sure, you know, go for it. So I cut across the alluvial terraces there and headed for the trail up the Nanquip Trail, and then ran up that to Tilton Mesa.
Right.
And then found the route down. It's just a straightforward walk, basically, down the slope to Barbancita.
Right.
And walked around that, and I had a rope with me just in case. And I thought, well, I don't know if I can do this, right? So I found a place that looked reasonable. I threw the rope over the top, walked back around the other side, secured the rope, and then started up this little chimney. It was an open book, a corner.
Mm-hmm.
And you really didn't need the rope at all.
Right.
So yeah, I checked off another summit, right? It was so great because I got, on that trip, I got Novinger, Allsap, and then Barbancita.
Mm.
And at that point, Barbancita I had done all of the Butte Fault summits with the exception of Malgosa Crest.
Right.
So it was pretty cool to have to tick that one off.
And Barbancita it's kind of out there in the middle of nowhere. It's kind of surrounded. It's got Nanquip, Little Nanquip off to the northeast and the main Nanquip directly to the south of it. You've got to come in Tilted Mesa from Little Nanquip. There is a little route that comes up from Main Nanquip, which is pretty fun too. But it is kind of out there in the middle of nowhere. Gorgeous view.
Oh yeah, for sure. And like you say, it's out there, and it's a fairly easy route to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you do have to walk quite a distance, and there's no water out there or anything like that.
Right.
So I'd love to spend more time in that area. I mean, I've never gone into the upper valley of Little Nanquip Creek, you know, above the Redwall Dry Fall, and I'd like to spend some time up in there and see what's to be seen. And of course, I want to check out that route you've talked about from Lower Nanquip through the Redwall, right? That I think I know where that is because I've noted it on my map for 40 years, you know. That there's looks like a possible Redwall route there, but
there is, and it goes, and it's a sporty climb, but there it is. So.
Good.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I managed to get back down to those guys by dark,
right?
And they had actually moved their camp. They moved their gear up to the junction of the arm between that comes down from Marion Sieber Point and the other northwest arm of Nanquip. So I had to, walk by headlamp up to that junction to join them because they had moved the camp up there. And we had planned to do that. That was the plan, that they would locate the camp up there. So they just let me have my time romping up Barbancita Butte.
Cool.
And then, of course, the next day we just went out Marion Sieber route and back to the vehicle at Saddle Mountain. So fairly uneventful.
Excellent.
Day.
Excellent. That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So very nice trip, and again, I ticked off three summits. So it was very satisfying in that sense. And I was expanding my list, starting to expand my list, kind of significantly.
Right.
So.
Right. Of summits. Excellent. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up part 10. We've been talking about an hour here, and this would get us set up for your next adventure after April 1996.
Okay. Sounds great.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part 10 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, April 18th, 2021, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.